Hello, everybody, and welcome to Buffalo Bills Maybe Next Year, the only podcast which is seemingly never in danger of having to change its name. I'm Paul.
I'm Scott.
I'm Frank.
All right. And, you know, before we get into the streaming diarrhea of negativity, which is about to follow, I do want to say, you know, one, we're really glad that Tom and some of our other listeners got to attend the game. You know, that we were, and he was able to watch in person what was undeniably an exciting game. You know, it's one thing we take for granted here. You know, I live in Buffalo and have 8 chances a year. And you guys in D.C., the Bills are coming there this year. Plus, they always play in Baltimore, New York, Pittsburgh, Philly, other places easily accessible by, you know, train, plane, or car, bus, all sorts of ways to get there quickly. So I'm glad you got to go, Tom. So a shout-out to you and all our other listeners who got to enjoy it and teach soccer chants. Excuse me, real football chants, not American football chants. And then also I wanted to mention we seem to have stumbled upon a rotational system for leading the discussion of this podcast. It's working pretty well. So as such, next week until Frank's back in the rotation, you can expect Scott to resume his Tyrod Taylor-ish role, whereas today I'm going to go for more Matt Castle than EJ Manuel. So that's going to be my goal for the day.
I'm going to be the I'm going to be the Matt Flynn of the quarterback group for a little while. But then I'll roll right back into being Ryan Fitzpatrick.
Right. Then I know it's Claudia Jean has hit that month-old plus mark. You know, then we'll get him back in.
Right.
So her back, Frank back in. All right, so now on to the streaming diarrhea of negativity that we promised. So not only did the Bills lose to the Jaguars, they lost to the Jaguars at a neutral site that had more Bills fans than really any other fans. So really, they lost what was quote-unquote a road game on their schedule, which wasn't really on the road. It was at a neutral site and which featured many more Bills fans. So with that in mind, you know, your impressions on the game, Mr. Scott.
I think it was surprising to me that the team was terrible. I did not see that coming. I think the biggest surprise within that was that EJ Manuel, I mean, again, EJ's had bad games for us. This was arguably definitely one of the worst. I mean, I just said arguably definitely. It was definitely one of the worst.
But it's definitely arguable.
No, it's arguably definitely. But I think the main thing, yeah, so that was really the thing that bothered me the most was it seemed as though competent, below average quarterback play would have won that game for us, and it was something that we did not get. And that's counting EJ kind of semi bringing us back into the game a little bit in the second half. Something that I don't think, you know, again, Jacksonville playing a prevent defense was a lot of that.
He took the lead. Like, you know, it wasn't semi bringing it back. They took the lead, so.
Okay. Well, it wasn't really him, though, because it was Corey Graham returning a interception for a touchdown that actually gave us the go-ahead touchdown.
Details.
Just to be clear.
Details.
Just to be clear exactly what happened there.
Don't muddle this with facts, Scott. Come on.
So that brings me to another point, which was EJ Manuel's comeback may not have been enabled if it wasn't for the fact that Jacksonville is a truly, truly terrible team.
True.
And they take some horrible, horrible decisions, including, you know, a number of series where Blake Bortles was throwing basically 2 or 3 times during a 3-and-out when they're up, and were running the ball with great effectiveness with T.J. Yeldon. That was bizarre. Obviously, Bortles making a terrible decision to throw up that Hail Mary when all he had to do was just take a punt and instead giving it to Corey Graham where he could run it back for a touchdown. A lot of bizarre decisions by Jacksonville led us back into the game that we really should never have been let back into, and yet we were still not able to do it. Obviously, the defense coming up short to a certain extent in crunch time, definitely coming up short in crunch time, but at the end of the day, I still think, I would say it was an improvement for the defense over what we saw in the Cincinnati game at the very least. Obviously, Cincinnati's much better than Jacksonville, and that explains a lot of it, but at the same time, the defense was able to score 7 points, and if you take off the 14 points that EJ basically handed Jacksonville on a silver platter, as well as the 3 points that he kind of handed them with the other interception or fumble, I forget what it was, that, you know, I think it's a much different game, and we'd be looking at the defense a lot differently. That's a lot of thoughts there.
Right. But, I think one thing, when you were talking about the poor decisions, and you brought up Yeldon, let's remember they had first and goal at the 1.
Right. The 4 cracks.
EJ Yeldon once, ran 4 times with I forgot.
Toby Gerhardt.
Yeah, Toby Gerhardt. I was just going to call him Larry Kinnebrew because I never remember his name.
And then they also had, there was another time where they handed the ball, I think, to a defensive lineman on a fullback dive instead of giving it to TJ Yeldon.
That's right, yeah.
It's another terrible, terrible decision. Again, the guy had been running for, 20 carries, 115 yards, 5.8 average. Give him the ball when you're up by three scores. It's not rocket science. But Jacksonville apparently was very close to outthinking themselves. Luckily, they were playing EJ Manuel and a terrible Bills team as well, or at least a team playing terrible that Sunday.
The Bills are terrible with EJ Manuel. I mean, he single-handedly destroyed that football game. For any, I was sort of like I wasn't really teasing. I just wanted to make do. The Bills, it was pretty miraculous that the Bills got back into that game at all, even down to Jacksonville, with any sort of semi-competent play by Jacksonville, and any sort of giving up on the Bills, and that game is just an absolute stinker from top to bottom. So I wanted to credit them for at least not losing interest the way that I kind of did, and it was only because there was no other football games on, and it was only 11 in the morning here that I didn't go do something else.
You realize you weren't blowing your day by watching it. You were just blowing your morning, which most people do on Sunday morning anyway.
Right. I was kind of finishing coffee, and I was playing with my baby on the couch, and we just was like, I didn't really feel like playing PlayStation yet, and so that's what we did. We kept the game on, and it was sort of strangely they got back into it. So I wanted to credit them for that because, as Paul said, it was an exciting game. It was one of the few terrible games that I feel like was at least fun. Like, I don't know, like, I didn't hate watching that game. But it was a real turd. By the way, I looked up quickly on Pro Football Reference. That was the 10th best game of 16 starts for EJ Manuel. He actually had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 games worse by quarterback rating. I don't know about the QBR. They lost 27-6 to Tampa in 2013.
That was when he, pitched that screen pass out to the left and defensive line's like, all right, thank you, I'll just take that.
Right. That was a 31.2 QBR. Now, to your, let's see. By the way, the game just above that was a loss, this loss to Cincinnati. And the game just below it was a loss to Cleveland. So he's strongly in loss territory. He's smack dab in the middle of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 losses. There are 8 losses bunched together with his quarterback rating from 86.7 all the way down to 59.4 that they lost. And he's smack dab in the middle. And I think that says a lot of exactly what the Bills are. The Bills need you to be an 85-plus quarterback rating, right? They need you to be on the low end of good to win, and that's this year, and that's against other teams. And it was an atrocious performance by him, and I think that what was lost in a lot of this game was a kind of nice performance by LeSean McCoy, a pretty decent day by Robert Woods, an okay performance by the defense. Like, definitely they could have played better. But they did get a turnover with points, and they did get some sacks. But EJ Manuel was brutal. He was beyond brutal. He was double brutal. He was awful. And the only person playing worse than EJ Manuel, as far as I'm concerned right now, is Matt Cassel. which we'll talk about later, but just quickly as a preview, my opinion will be that if Matt Cassel had started or come into that game, it's the difference between the Bills losing 34-31 and the Bills losing 16-13. I think that's kind of the difference in the game. The only thing going forward is that EJ Manuel is not going to be quarterback unless he has to. And if they're his, I guess to put this loss in context, it's cruddy that the Bills lost to New England and Cincinnati. It's unfortunate that they're at the beginning part of the schedule. But you already had a game that you needed to win that you lost on the schedule, which is New York, and now you lose to Jacksonville. And it's only by the grace of the terrible AFC, which Paul will get us to later, that they're even in the AFC in the hunt for a wild card. So, terrible football game, but strangely, doesn't harbored the end of the season.
It does not. I think one point I should bring up, Frank, and you can let me know your opinion on this too, Did you think that it was all an unfair advantage that Jaguars linebacker Telvin Smith, when he was in London, borrowed Harry Potter's invisibility cloak? Because, I mean...
He was pretty crazy.
Manuel obviously didn't see him on the pick six and threw it right at him two other times, and I'm thinking, damn it, you can't see it on the replay, of course. In the replay, he's visible, but he was obviously wearing that invisibility cloak for, you know, most of the duration of that game.
If it was just the invisibility cloak, I would have been okay with it because, hey, you know, gamer's gonna game, right? But he also definitely borrowed the Doctor Who's TARDIS and went back in time to shortly before, you know, he clearly saw that play the first time and then went back in time and told himself, this is what the play is gonna be. And Henry was not having it.
No, this is Henry is now hearing about the Bills firsthand, and this is the reaction.
But he definitely went back in time using the TARDIS and told the line, you know, told himself how to intercept the pass. And when you're monkeying around with the time-space continuum, like, that goes a little beyond what's acceptable as far as, you know, football.
Yep, too much. I think if there's one thing we can agree, it's that the Jaguars were far too involved in English art and literature and movies as well. So, you know, British film, again, does the Bills in because the Jaguars, of course, are used to this sort of scenario.
Now, much to our preseason preview, the Bills definitely played like they had the Black Plague.
Very well put. Yeah, that was a good scenario that was created there. And I think what's funny, too, is, Frank, you had a nightmare about this game that basically came true.
It really did. And I had tweeted it and did a little bump of what I had tweeted the day before. And I was kind of sad that I picked the Jaguars, but in my heart of hearts, I knew something fishy was going to happen, and I was really hoping that I had managed to, like, see the beginning of the game, and then, like, they took the lead, and I thought, okay, it was all true, right? Like, they are good enough to be a terrible team, but they also got down three scores, but I don't know, man. It smelled a lot like Christmas past with this football team, so...
Yeah, absolutely. One thing we forget in the midst of the comeback and blowing it at the end and the big plays in the second quarter, some of the things in the first quarter that really did the Bills in as well. Remember that Manuel hit Greg on a deep pass, but underthrew it by about 6 or 7 yards maybe. Greg, instead of being in the end zone, was stopped just outside the 10. So then what happens is they run a wildcat play that lost some yardage, looked terrible to begin with, and yet ended up being their best offensive play of that sequence, because then Manuel threw a pass to Greg, where Chris Greg apparently was running on a CFL field, unbeknownst to most people. He was just standing out of bounds when he caught the ball, and I thought, well, that's one strategy. I don't think it's really going to work, though. And then, of course, Manuel threw a terrible pass. They got a field goal, and then the second quarter happened, and that really did them in. You did mention, Frank, and I think it's important to note, watching LeSean McCoy run the ball was really a pleasure in this game. Seeing that burst, seeing him cut and find those holes, it was the first time I've watched him since he came here where I thought, oh, that's the guy. That's the guy we paid for. I understand now why they've spent an arm and a leg on a running back when that position is generally regarded to be one of the ones where it's easier to find a player. So, you know, that was a good sign. Colton Schmidt was, again, good on special. The special teams was a mixed bag. You had Schmidt and, oh, by the way, I noticed we have not talked about kick coverage at all because we re-signed Jordan Gay. And I think this was all part of Rex Ryan's strategy of saying, everyone complains, not everyone, but a lot of people aren't in favor of a kickoff specialist. Let's go 2 weeks without one, see how disastrously it goes, and then we will be, you know, embraced when we bring the guy back out of the club.
He's a mad genius, that Rex Ryan. It's a bold choice. Willing to sabotage his own team to prove a point. That's always what I want in a
head. That's what I want in a head.
That's what you need. You can't be afraid of the short term. He's going to sabotage those games if he has to. But yeah, defensively overall, you know, you'd like to see them close out at the end. We can get to the pass interference call when we talk about officiating issues later in the pod. We can talk about some of the other things that went against them, that they played well as a whole. But at the end of the game, they had a chance to close it out and did not. We expected this. I shouldn't say we expected this team. We often said about this team that the defense was going to have to steal games. We do not need them to play to the elite level. We thought they could. We need them to play at a top NFL defense level. Right now, they're playing at a slightly above average defense level. And frankly, when the offense is as bad as it is, you just can't. That's not going to, you know, qualify. It's not going to get the job done. So I was happy with the defense overall, but again, in the grand scheme of what this team is, the defense, fair or not, is going to be expected to do more than they did last week, which is saying a lot considering they, you know, scored 7 points, helped stopped a 9-minute opening drive, although that was their own fault for letting it go 9 minutes in the second half. So some of those were the takeaways from the game. I think you have to look at the end, though. You know, the team is below 500 for the first time in 2 years. You're down to 9 games to go. You've only got 4 left at home. We were only 1-3 to begin with. And you had a backup quarterback, which cost the team the game. So with those particular things in mind, do we want to go to 3 stars and then talk about some of the other facets related to the game?
Yeah, I can do 3 stars quickly.
All right, we'll knock on through it.
All right, so no honorable mention this week because both teams played terrible. And when both teams play terrible, no one gets an honorable mention because it was hard enough to find 3 stars in this atrocious game. Your third star is going to be LeSean McCoy. I was thinking about giving it to Woods, who was, as people mentioned, was nice to see him kind of step up for Sammy and like, oh yeah, Robert Woods was pretty good on this team before we had Sammy Watkins, and he still can be. It's just we need to be able to get him the ball just as easily as we can do everyone else when we have, you know, like a working quarterback. But it is LeSean McCoy because of what you guys said. It was nice to see him out there. Obviously, you know, the crunch on the fumble, you know, obviously a huge hit, coughed up the ball. Right. Hard to blame him for that one. You know, he was trying to protect himself, going to the ground, just kind of got caught bad on it. But I think without him, it's definitely a different game, and I don't think the Bills are nearly as close getting back into it, whereas I think Frank's correct. If you put Matt Cassel in, or E.J. Manuel, or replacement-level NFL quarterback, the Bills never get into that position to begin with. So, so I'd say LeSean McCoy, with his 18 carries and 68 yards rushing, as well as his 2 catches and 36 yards passing, is your third star. Your second star is going to be the aforementioned man with the cloak of invisibility, Telvin Smith, with 9 tackles, 2 for a loss, 3 pass deflections, and 1 interception, another definitely should have been an interception. I was trying to remember the third. You guys were saying it was a good one. But yeah, I mean.
Oh, the Posluszny interception.
Oh, the Posluszny one. Yeah, that another one that EJ never even saw.
How bad a game did he have that an interception by Paul Posluszny escapes our attention?
Again, it was just another interception as far as I was concerned. they all blur together. But, Smith was pretty well. Again, you know, a guy that was probably wouldn't have done as well if Carlos Williams was in the game a little bit, a lighter linebacker, more athletic type. But frankly, he played really well and was able to cash in the interception with a touchdown, which, again, given how the game went, you're never really sure if you were able to get some of those interceptions and turnovers into points. I mean, that was one of the big things I was yelling at Corey Graham when he was running back that interception was, you have to get in the end zone. I have no confidence we will get into the end zone if you do not get us into the end zone.
Right. Nick Coy proved that by getting down to about the 4, and he's like, yeah, I'm just going to give him the ball now.
And then the first star was T.J. Yeldon, the aforementioned T.J. Yeldon, with his one catch for 9 yards, also 20 carries for 115 yards and a touchdown. He was the one who kind of stirred Jacksonville's drink. Bortles had, technically, yes, he did throw 2 touchdowns, but otherwise had a pretty terrible game. Whereas T.J. Yeldon was the man in Jacksonville who could actually kind of sustain drives. I'm pretty sure Jacksonville would have put the game away earlier had he gotten the ball more. And so that is why he is the first star. That is it.
All right. So when we talk about, you know, the 3 stars of the game, that kind of what we generally do to wrap up our discussion of the game. However, there were some greater questions that emerged from this game as a result of what happened out on that field. And I think one of the most interesting ones is the Matt Cassel question, if you will. Was trading Matt Cassel the right decision based on that crap show we saw out of E.J. Manuel on Sunday? So many different ways to look at it. We put this out to you guys on Facebook. You guys had some great replies. I think we'll get into the replies on those, but I kind of want to start with you, Frank, because you're the one actually getting into this topic a little bit with Tim Graham, Buffalo News lead Bills reporter, former reporter for the Miami Dolphins as well. Talk about your views on, you know, the Cassel trade I won't even insert my own biases in it. Go right ahead.
The And at the outset, I got into it with Tim Graham because Tim Graham's the only guy I like out of like a whole bunch of people that are doing this. And for me, it's kind of disappointing because I think Graham is definitely like this is sort of what we like to call an argument from ignorance. It's a technical, logical fallacy that describes an idea where because you don't know something and you can't prove something, you can instantly make whatever conclusion you want about it. And so it's a very easy column for guys like Bucky Gleason and Jerry Sullivan and everybody at ESPN who has to write about the Bills and a whole bunch of other people to sit here and say, well, look at what a terrible game E.J. Manuel had. Would it not have been as good to have Matt Cassel, who we brought in and is a conservative type of quarterback, and it would have just been, well, something different. And for me, it needs to be more than it's something different, because all indications were that Matt Cassel was a pretty terrible quarterback, and that the coaching staff really didn't have much care for him. He didn't get a lot of he suddenly lost all of his snaps in preseason. He was cut. He was re-signed for a lot less money. And then traded away. And so there's a certain level of value that dictates about what the team thought about him. And I understand that there might be some tension between the coaching staff and Doug Whaley, but I there can't be that much tension between the two because they just sort of let him go twice and got rid of him. So for me, it becomes this sort of like garbage argument that is really about kicking Whaley for something, you know, there's plenty of things to kick Whaley about.
Just ask Scott.
Right. We don't need to kick him over this, and we certainly don't need to be presenting a terrible, fake, false-ass garbage argument about how the Bills should have kept him, but then not have to really finish that thought, because there was evidence that he was terrible beforehand, and then there was current evidence that he was terrible the exact same day as E.J. Manuel, and further evidence
they probably beat the Giants that day without him, the Cowboys.
Right. And there's further evidence that he was terrible this past Sunday. So, you know, you can't really and a lot of it was on Twitter, guys like Graham and Gleason were saying things like, well, you know, you can't really count Castle's performance for some reason, even though the entire springboard for the conversation is how poorly E.J. Manuel has played. You can't do that. You have to look at these guys and how good they are and compare them. And the only way that we have to compare them is to say that Castle did not impress when he was in Buffalo, and he certainly hasn't shown anything since. And frankly, even before he was in Buffalo, there was a lot of evidence that he was a pretty bad quarterback. So that's why I like to say that I was saying, you know, Manuel loses that game 34-31 because, frankly, he does have some skill sets that allow him to get back into that game. He has a strong arm, and when his mechanics are good and he's, I don't know, for some reason throwing the ball well, he can make some pretty awesome passes. Matt Cassel can't throw the ball that well. Matt Cassel can't throw some of the touchdowns that E.J. Manuel threw. End of story, period. The only difference is he probably doesn't turn over the ball three times in 8 minutes. And hand Jacksonville 21 points. So in that case, in my mind, it's just as likely the Bills lose 16-13 as win 16-13. So I guess really because people want to draw – it's just sort of like you don't know what can happen with Matt Cassel because – and we'll never know what would have happened. So it's very easy to just project whatever we want onto that. And you know what, that's a shitty, stupid thing to do, and if you're doing that, like, knock yourself, you know, knock it off. Go read up what an argument from ignorance is and just sort of cut it out, because we can't keep – that was the other thing. They said something about, like, well, you know, it would have just been more choices. Well, you know what, there was Josh Johnson on the bench too, and he's apparently been learning how to be a quarterback in the Bills situation. So if you really wanted a change of pace, you throw Josh Johnson in, and if you can't tell me what Josh Johnson – what exactly Matt Cassel was doing over the last 2 weeks that Josh Johnson couldn't do for Buffalo, you know, that would be a column I'd like to see any one of those hacks write, frankly. And again, I don't think Graham's a hack, but he's sort of turning himself into, like, this caricature, and it's right. Really sort of been disappointing for me, and I'm sure some of my personal feelings about that bled into my Twittering with him. So, I do shoulder shrug guy.
Right, and he is known to troll people a little bit. Now, Scott, you're on record as saying, you know, and by on record meaning on Facebook, saying, you know, with Castle's self-immolation, you don't think we'd be able to move on. But you don't think the Castle trade is one of Whaley's great fireable blunders?
No, I don't. I don't think that Whaley is a particularly great GM. I think he's a good scout. I don't think that he's made a good a number of good decisions about team construction, offensive line. I think, you know, by all accounts, Tyrod Taylor was a Rex Ryan kind of find, and he, you know, and to a certain extent, I think it's been proven that Doug is trying to try and work EJ back in as a variety of things. He can say, which I think a lot of GMs do, I think is something that's problematic. But at the end of the day, to say that Castle would have been a lot better is also not 100% true. I think we had two NFL, you know, I don't want to say like, I was trying to think of like what the expectation of an NFL backup quarterback is. Is it to be serviceable? Is it to win you a game one out of two times? Is it to do, like, what is the expectation? Because I was like, well, who are teams who lost quarterbacks this year? I mean, we obviously have Dallas. They had Brandon Whedon lose three games, and now Matt Castle leads two. Okay, well, so clearly backup quarterback can be terrible, but then Mike Vick and Landry Jones have both won games for Pittsburgh since Ben Roethlisberger's been out. So clearly there's some variation here of what a backup quarterback is capable of. I don't want to expect too much out of your backup, but I would say that counting on them to try and win a game for you is not a lot. So that's why I think having a lot of penance for Doug Whaley based off of the decision he makes about arguably the, I don't know, what do you want to say, like the 35th or 36th most important guy on the team, like that's not, to me, that's not something to throw him out over. Now, if you want to pile this onto a list of many other things, sure. And I think people have been doing that. I think some people who have already kind of been tenuous about Whaley are using this to their advantage. And in the sense of moving towards an outcome that gets him out, I'm in favor of that. But I also, you know, analytically, sanely, rationally, I also don't want to overinflate the importance of a decision about a backup quarterback, or between two mediocre backup quarterbacks, I should say.
Yeah, and I think Tom made a good point in response, which I think would be the one argument you could make, because I agree with both of you gentlemen, which is that, you know, the team is allegedly in win now mode, and this is a loss to a team that I don't know if they lose. You know, Frank, know that he thinks they lose 16-13 or so.
Because, well, they could, right? Like, right. Would you be that surprised? That's all I'm saying.
No, absolutely wouldn't be surprised if they'd done that with Castle, and even still, the way I come back, even though I kind of agree with Tom's general point, which is that, you know, EJ probably does, or Castle probably doesn't, you know, give up 21 points in such a short span of time. Say we all agree, and I'm making this up, that Manuel lost this game, and maybe Castle wouldn't have lost this game. Well, is that a loss that keeps a mediocre team from the playoffs? I mean, it's not. We're going to talk about the AFC later, but it's not like, boy, this team is going to finish 12-4 and miss the playoffs because that one stupid loss to Jacksonville. If they make the playoffs, they will have earned it by doing a very good job the last nine games of the season and putting this one behind them, because it's still a competitive conference. So, you know, that's what makes me agree with you guys on this point. And, you know, Brian Punt, you know, noted the whole cut Castle, promote EJ, re-sign Castle, demote EJ, trade Castle saga was muddled. He's saying that, you know, it's obviously some disagreement among the front office and the coaching staff. But he's right. He said doesn't personally think either is good. Doubt we would have had any more success with Castle. So there's agreement there. Would Castle have let it come back? No. I'd agree with that, too. Steven disagrees and said, the Jags are pretty awful. But remember, EJ did leave the comeback. You know, he did get them back out of that hole. It's just they
Corey Graham interception notwithstanding. Right.
Right. Yes. But he led them back to the cusp. And of course, let's not forget, we're going to also note that LeSean McCoy fumbled inside the 5-yard line. And if that doesn't happen, maybe EJ does officially lead the comeback. You know, you know, as Steven rightly points out, the Castle played against a much better team on Sunday with the Giants, and he did this week again against the Seahawks with good defenses. But he still didn't do anything that, you know, made me think, oh, yeah, this guy's really going to separate himself. So we can go into – I think we've probably covered this topic. You know, would the Bills have won the game if Taylor started? I would absolutely say yes. You know, I think that he's just – I think – we no longer look at the Taylor versus Castle versus Manuel like as a, let's look at the pluses and minuses and compare them. It's clearly Tyrod Taylor that's the best of those three QBs. Yeah. I don't know if there's much of an argument on that one anymore.
There's one more point if I could make it, because a lot
it's a free show, you know. Go right
ahead. Okay, yeah, free. Right. One more argument that I was reading a lot was that a lot of the consternation comes down to basically the fact that you didn't really get very much in return for Castle, and you're basically, you know, swapping some picks and some low round picks, and does future left guard that, you know, only plays two seasons, is that worth trading a backup quarterback? And I guess I can understand that, but I think that the only thing I would say to that is if you're already there where you're talking about what's worth it for Castle, then you in principle aren't against the trade. Like, you're actually okay with him. You just wanted more for it. And so I could, you know, talk you into it if I said, well, what if he had gotten a fifth rounder?
You just don't know what the market is for the backup quarterback position in the NFL.
Right, that's it. And so it might be, you might say, well, I think that Whaley could have gotten more for him. Like, all right, I guess, but I don't know. I mean, I think that the market's pretty clear that Matt Castle is probably worth trading up some stuff, and I guess you could make your own decisions about whether it's worth it at all. But if we're talking about whether it's worth it at all, then you actually do, in principle, agree with the trade. You just didn't like the price you paid for it. And yeah, so,
and what's funny that makes me agree with you, and I hate to say this aloud, but it makes you realize why the Patriots have been so good for many years. Who had the successful trade involving Castle? Bill Belichick got a second-round pick for a guy by trade from at the peak of his career, and everyone else has just been kind of treading water with Castle since that trade.
Yeah.
So, I was going to, you know, do we want to move on off the Castle manual topic? Are we good? We're good. I think I got to take some deep breaths and just be like, oh, man, it hurts to talk about crappy quarterbacks, and we really want Tyrod back, which leads us into our next, sort of discussion here. So, injuries and officiating, are these relevant excuses, or are the fans ignoring some of the real problems with the team? And by fans, I'm including us. And since we were talking about Tyrod specifically, I think we'll start with you, Scott. Do you think the injuries and the officiating have cost the Bills games this year? Would they be a 5-2 without it? Okay.
Yes, absolutely. I think the injuries, yes. I think the officiating, it's more debatable. I think you are going to have games that officiating wins you and loses you. I think that those games, by over the course of the season, will end up evening out to a certain extent. I mean, it would be interesting. I know that they can do fancy stats for injury games lost or starter games lost over the course of a season, and those definitely have impacts on the performances of teams. It would be pretty interesting to see like an adjusted stat of like of penalties and you know, affected impact on the game, you know, where you're taking into account the time and call of a penalty, because a roughing the passer in the first quarter with 15 minutes left is completely different than one on fourth down, fourth and 20 in the fourth quarter, down three on the opponent's, you know, 50-yard line. Those are completely different. One of those penalties is going to win you the game. The other one's, you know, is basically meaningless. That said, the injuries, it's much more clear. I think I was on, like I said on Facebook, Tyrod wins that game on Sunday in London. And the other thing is, I think, to a certain extent, we as Bills fans have been so decimated, so lost in the desert of quarterback terribleness, that we don't know what it might be like to have a good quarterback and to understand that the difference between your starting quarterback and your backup quarterback is actually fairly substantial and can lead to wins and losses on its own. I think that for many years, the difference between J.P. Lossman and Trent Edwards, or Ryan Fitzpatrick and E.J. Manuel, ultimately those were differences without distinction. Those were two shades of a different crappy apple. I'm just completely making up metaphors now.
Yeah, I was going to say too. That we've got to remember that one as a potential title when we assess this at the end of the podcast.
Two shades of a crappy apple.
Yeah.
I will say, you know, are there real problems with this team? Yeah. Does the defense not look like it really understands Rex Ryan's scheme? Yeah. Is the special teams all that great? Not really. But officiating can affect affect the game. I think that will even out to a certain extent, even if this team ends up being a little more penalized. I think the injuries are a thing where it absolutely will impact games. And all you have to do is look at Dallas. I mean, without Roman and without Bryant, they're 0-5, basically. And they've been in some of those games. We were in the game in Jacksonville, and we were in most of the game in Cincinnati, but we lost both of them. And you lose your number one quarterback and your number one wideout, it's hard to win games. It is, even against terrible teams.
Yeah, you know, injuries are the easy one, right? Obviously, injuries matter. And to lose depth at the same position over and over is kind of what hurts. Like, you could imagine playing a couple of games with a guy like, well, I mean, we assume Carlos Williams would have kept playing pretty well, but he was playing pretty well. And so you lose McCoy, and you're like, okay, we can do that with Williams. You lose Watkins, that's not great. But if you lose Watkins and Percy Harvin, and then Goodwin on top of it, and you just start, like, getting crushed at positions the Bills were kind of deep at, that, and by the way, we're, like, meant to make up for the fact that there isn't much of a quarterback in Buffalo, well, then you start looking like a terrible team without a quarterback, you know? You start, because that's what they are. They're sort of, all sorts of teams would fall apart. If you lose Tom Brady today, you know, the Patriots become a very different team. If you lose Tom Brady and Rob Gronkowski, they're a 2-4-13 team. Like, that's probably the difference between, you know, 16-0 and 2-13.
Please lose Tom Brady and Rob Gronkowski.
Right? 2-13-1. Sorry, I got to add to 16. But, like, that could be it. Like, what is that team without those two players? They're nothing. They're, like, they had no defense to begin with. So that's what we're, you know, injuries are easy. As far as penalties, I think the NFL has a problem on its hand. I really do. I think that there are serious issues with inconsistencies about all sorts of things, including how holds are called in the same game. You know, when there's very clear holding on the last play of the Jacksonville
Jerry
drive.
Jerry was just being grabbed, which I noted to my dad while the play was in progress.
He just was mauled. He was absolutely held up at gunpoint, basically.
Right, and mind you, we're not guys who are so observant, like, you know what, I'm going to watch each offensive lineman on this play. It was so obvious that all of us, who are all admitted ball watchers when the game is going on, obviously noticed, like, hey, that ain't right. You can't be doing that.
There were, like, five people in the frame, a referee, the lineman, Hughes, the quarterback, and one other guy, and so there were only, like, five people you could look at, and there was Jerry Hughes with his hands up and the other guy with his hands around him. And, you know, do they come back and score? Maybe. But you know what? Like, we should find out whether they come back and score. And it's kind of ridiculous because you'll spend 20 minutes – well, not 20 minutes. You'll spend 7, 8, 9 minutes figuring out if something was a catch or not with all sorts of convoluted nonsense about football moves and going to the ground. And they won't take a look at what is, like, a really serious, like, issue. Like, if you have a defensive line like Buffalo and that's your bread and butter and guys are getting away with holds, well, that's terrible. That's just terrible. And it cost them this game, and there were other penalties throughout the year that were kind of garbage. You know, all penalties are different. There was the celebration in the end zone, which really didn't hurt them at all, because even though it was a 15-yard penalty on the kickoff, it ended up going to the, you know, 17-yard line or something. Yeah. That's where Jacksonville started their drive. So, you know, I get that not all penalties are created equal, but there needs to be they need to either just sort of, like, do away with holding and, like, you're allowed to hold and that's just like, and the defense gets two more guys or something to compensate for holding, or they need to tape the hands of all defensive linemen and offensive linemen so no one can hold, because I don't think they're ever going to, like, catch all of this holding. I understand that, but it's still garbage when there's, like, one guy out in space and Jerry Hughes is holding him, and there's literally nothing else for the line judge to be looking at. The line judge, like, that's him, right? Is it, like, do we have to hire three more referees? Will that solve the problem? I don't know, but, like, it's just... it's garbage. It's just garbage.
Right, and I'd agree on the officiating with Frank's point. Now, Scott's noted that, you know, it tends to even out over the course of a season. I would agree with that, too, because I think what happens, especially during the bye week, is the Bills will say, look at this film of what's happened to Jerry Hughes here. Take another look at this pass interference penalty. Start grading these officials more heavily. Stop picking on us because we have a reputation for committing these penalties, and you hope that that gets noticed in the second half of the year, and we do start to see it even out a little bit. The point that you make, Frank, though, is so salient. You know, the calls that are being made are just, you know, diluting the value of the product that the NFL says is this exceptional product, in which the free market seems to at least indicate it is, and which we obviously indicate are, and that we are three men with jobs and families who have great satisfaction in life, and yet here we are spending an hour of our valuable, precious time on a weeknight talking about football. So you know what? They've won. The NFL has beaten us.
Yeah.
All that said, you know, the official on the pass interference play, which I was thinking of, clearly influenced by everything that was around him. A wide receiver who, as he was falling to the ground, decides to pull off an acting job, which, by the way, should be a 15-yard penalty for attempts to deceive an official, taunting. I think it all falls under the unsportsmanlike conduct umbrella that you could utilize. And, you know, the Jacksonville Jaguars bench screamed at him, and he threw that flag immediately. And what bothered me most about it is, you know, there's a lot of money at stake in this profession. You cannot throw a flag for something you did not see. If you miss a penalty, I have less issue with the Hughes penalty because, you know, as Frank said, maybe, you know, that guy should be looking at the line judge should be looking at that the whole time. Maybe he got distracted by another going on near the play, saw that, didn't see the hold on Hughes. Maybe he had a bad angle because Hughes was moving his way around the lineman really quickly. All sorts of potential scenarios. But when a referee throws a flag for something that just didn't happen, that can't happen. That has no place in the game. And, you know, I think it's very unfortunate that play happened. It could have set up a 4th-and-16. Now maybe the Bills have a defensive hold on 4th-and-16, or maybe what's more than likely is Jacksonville punts. The Bills could end up going 3-0 out, which God knows they would, because they couldn't convert 3rd-and-1 with a quarterback sneak. And, you know, they could have very easily, pathetically given it back to the Jaguars, and the Jaguars score at the end of the game, and it's even more heartbreaking. But all that said, you know, these officiating issues need to improve. That said, I don't think in any way that they cost. I shouldn't say in any way. That's not what cost the Bills the game. If those had happened, as you noted, I think it was Frank, you were the one who made the point, it all depends on, you know, what point of the game it is, how much that penalty means. And these were penalties happening at key points in the game that meant a lot, but they shouldn't have been key points in the game because the Bills shouldn't have put themselves in a position where they mattered. And on the official injury topic, which I guess, you know, we can kind of lean into, you know, we can lean to that a little bit separately. Scott touched on it a little bit, too. But they've definitely had an impact. You know, Tyrod being out especially had an effect on this team. EJ being on the field is what had a bad impact on this team. Sammy Watkins being injured. We saw Kyle Williams, you know, not in the center of the football field. Darius played out of his mind again last week, but he's going to be less effective over time, and you don't have Kyle next to him. You had the Sammy Watkins injury, as mentioned. LeSean was out for a couple games. Carlos Williams, you know, who was giving them depth at running back, has been out. I think every one of those things has contributed to the Bills losing games. That said, despite those injuries, I think there's the defense has had opportunities to help carry the offense, has not done so to win games. I think especially in that Cincinnati game, that was apparent. And then this last game, the offense, despite the injuries, there's no excuse to give up 21 points in that shorter span in the second quarter. So I think they're relevant to point out injuries in officiating, but I think there comes a point where you're like, okay, these excuses they're excuses, and we've got to get beyond them. As fans, and hopefully the team realizes, you know, what's done is done. You can't change reality, so, you know, put it in your rear view and just do the best that you
can. Yeah, the biggest thing is, you know, we can argue about these things as fans about whether they cost the team or not. The team can't really worry about it. The coaching staff can complain to the league and try and work the officials like they do on the sidelines every week, and that is part of their job as coaches. But the players just have to go out and play and assume that the refs are going to screw them every time anyway, so that's why they just have to try that much harder. I mean, there's not much that they... This is all just kind of us talking. There's not much the players can do other than just try not to also taunt their
opponents,
too. Yeah. No, that is true.
Right. So that's what's great. It's speculation. That's what we love doing, to speculate, and we will have a career doing this, a career that pays us no money, but a career doing this for as long
that's
as...
That's why I like doing it for no money, because I would feel terrible if I was one of the people who speculated and made money, because, you know, you can just listen to us fucking blow smoke up your ass, and maybe that satisfies the itch as opposed to giving Skip Bayless money. I don't know.
Right, yeah. I always think sports, so this is a good off-season topic, which will, you know, get some whiskey and some scotch and smoke some cigars discussing is, how the hell do the people who get paid to do this get paid to do it? Because they're not really that much better than us, you know? That's another opinion for another. Like, at least Joe Biscaglia, I'll point him out. I don't always necessarily trust his observations, but at least I know he's looking at all 22 video footage and analyzes every single play. And, you know, he's at least doing the research. But so many of these guys, I think, are just glorified fans. I mean, I spent more time putting together notes for our podcast for our loyal listeners who pay us no money, don't pay for advertising or anything, than these guys do. But again, I think I've streamed way off topic, and this will be a great discussion for March.
That's a good conversation about which journalists, because, you know, we're pretty upfront. We're not journalists. We don't go out and figure things out. We rely on a lot of the work of others. And so who do we like? There are a lot of good reporters out there that are actually doing decent work, and they should be commended for it. And
you should talk about that. Did you guys see the Onion thing with not the Onion thing, the Weird Al Yankovic thing, where he had the sports interview, like generic sports interview, where it was like he was like generic old coach, and they had like generic star player, generic bench player who suddenly played good, and they had a bunch of guys in the audience, and it was like, hi, I'm anonymous sports blogger. I'd like to ask you for a quote that I can then take out of context in my next article.
Very nice.
That's pretty.
That's what we're doing, and I've got to catch that sketch when I have a chance. So we'll move on. We were talking about the injuries, so let's talk about the returning players. Pretty much everyone except Kyle should be coming back, with a possible exception of maybe Sammy. Looks like Carlos will even be back if he can pass through his tests. And let's not forget Liotis coming back to the team and perhaps making a difference on the field, though I think all of us are vastly opposed to him taking Ron Darby's position, which 10 weeks ago was laughable that any of us would make that statement, and now I think we'd probably have universal agreement on that.
Yes.
I think I'll just comment. Commenting briefly, I think this is going to help immensely. Tyrod, obviously, the biggest plus. I think they're going to be a different team offensively. I think the passing defense should benefit from Liotis being there. I think that loss of Kyle is going to hurt, maybe not so much on pass defense, but a bit on the rush defense, as we saw what Yeldon was able to do last week. I don't want to go too in-depth into this, but I think I'll move it over to, you know what, I'll throw it out there and see which one of you jumps at this. What do you think, how do you think their returning players are going to help in the coming weeks?
They're going to win more football games.
I think they'll be a better team.
Yeah, that's. I think getting Tyrod back is the linchpin to the whole deal. He is, frankly, the most important player already, even though we only know very little about him. I think we're also not getting Aaron Williams back, and I think there's a good chance we're not getting Percy Harvin back, because I think no one really knows what happened to Percy Harvin still.
His hip was bitten by a zombie, or what is commonly called a walker, and he's been having trouble getting downfield.
Is this one of the Jamaican, like, fun-loving zombies that's kind of a person but sort of alive, or is this more of a rage-angry zombie? Because a rage-angry zombie, he's got a lot of range.
Right.
Unlimited endurance.
Yeah, I have a fear it's more of a remake of the Day of the Dead zombie versus a Serpent in the Rainbow zombie, if I had to quantify.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Well, that's not going to be as effective, dropping back in coverage there.
Right.
No. I heard some stuff about that McKelvin might play safety. Would be how he might fit in.
Yeah, they just introduced that topic to him today.
Yeah, that is odd. I wonder what they were waiting for, like, and given that, you know, he probably could have been installing the safety playbook a little bit in his, you know, mental reps during his injury. But
or even the bye week, and said, hey, we know you're not practicing this week, but just so you didn't mind, maybe take a look at safety assignments in the playbook this week.
Yeah, that seems like that would be worthwhile. But
unless there's some sort of union regulation against it, I guess that could be what the issue is.
I don't know, but I mean, it seems like with Aaron Williams, that's how he ended up, obviously, at safety. Was we drafted him sort of as a corner, and he played corner briefly before he moved to safety. I think that's a good position for Liotis. I think that might help him. Obviously, he's never been great with the ball skills, which is obviously something that you'd prefer in a decent safety, but as long as he can cover the ground, he's definitely fast enough to do that. And just frankly having him back on special teams is going to be nice enough. But yeah, and I also agree with Frank, though. I mean, if you asked me, would I rather have Tyrod back or would I rather have the rest of the injured guys back, it would be a tough call, but I'd still probably say Tyrod.
I would as well, because he's a leader. But the offense is different without him. At the very least, they're functional with him in there, and he puts up good QBR numbers. He puts up good quarterback rating numbers as well. And again, I think both of those systems are somewhat antiquated. It's not the right word, but they don't necessarily tell us everything you need to know. But I think they tell us that Tyrod at least knows how to efficiently run an offense and can make plays with his legs. And, you know, he's no Alex Smith, mind you, after watching that yesterday. But, you know, he can do something out there. And I would honestly take him over, you know, I think getting everyone else back. But, you know, the nice thing is, you know, we don't have to make a choice there. He can come back and others can come back.
Is LeSean McCoy okay?
Yeah, they didn't even mention him in the presser today, so I'm guessing that, you know, he's totally fine and good to go and should be 100%.
Yeah, all right. Ended up with a surprising high number of. I'm looking, and McCoy's failed. They're just talking. I'm reading his fantasy football profile, and there's no evidence that they think he's not going to play, so okay. But that was kind of a scary moment when he fumbled in London, so I wasn't sure.
Yeah, he got just popped. I assumed it was a concussion the way he got
hit. Yeah, I did too. That was kind of surprising, and obviously given our team's track record for pulling people prudently with injuries, you wonder if they how thorough that concussion protocol was. But I guess he was fine because he was playing later in that game, even still.
Yeah, and they say I guess the concussion tests are done on the sideline by. Not a team doctor, but by a league doctor, or not even a league doctor. I think it's by an independent contractor type.
Well, yeah, but they're paid by the league, so yeah, ultimately it's a league.
Right, so ultimately it's a league. And so they could, so don't get me wrong, there's still room for bias. Could be like, oh, I know this guy's a star player. I don't want the NFL to not let me in anymore. Maybe I'll let him on the field, but hopefully it at least removes some of the bias, even if it introduces other potential biases. So, yeah, I think the team will be better to watch this week than it was. Well, maybe not better to watch because it was an exciting game, as we all noted, but it should be a better team overall to watch. And speaking of it being a better team overall, I think the Bills found really the secret to improving their odds in the AFC standings is to not play, which they did a great job of doing this weekend.
100% successful in not losing a game.
They saw the bye week coming up, and they said, you know what, we're going to take this. We're not going to play, and we're going to watch everyone else collapse around us. And here we are, a 3-4 team going into our next game, and we are one game out of a wild card spot. I curiously looked back at some old NFL standings, and I want to point out this is somewhat reminiscent of me, and obviously there are differences, of the 1989 AFC standings, where the best team in the AFC, mild quiz, it was the Broncos. Does anyone want to guess their record?
What year was this?
It was 1989.
They were a 13-win team.
All right.
I will say the 1962 Chicago Cubs.
That's a good number.
Well, yeah, that's a good number.
Yeah.
not really an answer to the question, but I liked it anyway. The Broncos went 11-5 and were the best team in the AFC. No other team in the AFC had more than 9 wins. Literally, that was the only double-digit win team in the AFC. Mm. And this set of circumstances is a little bit different, of course, because you have 3 really good teams in the AFC. See, who haven't lost games, New England, Cincinnati, and Denver. And then beneath that is just intense amount of mediocrity to the point where now you think, is the 4th best team the Raiders in the AFC? They are standings-wise, well, technically 5th because the AFC South joke, which the Bills, of course, lost to Jacksonville on. But I did have them look back in 1989. There were 2 10-6 teams and a 9-7 team that missed the playoffs in the NFC. You can bet those teams were like, "Ah, oh, this is son of a bitch. This isn't fair. We played so well this season. You're letting in everyone in the AFC because no one there can win games." But the mediocrity in this, which I kind of want to bring up to you guys, is, you know, Steven had brought up on our page, you know, Bills need 7 wins out of the remaining 9 to finish 10-6. You know, and my response to that would be, well, does it matter if the team gets 10 wins? I don't think you're going to need 10 wins to get a wild card in the AFC this year. I don't see you know, either of the 4-3 teams necessarily going 6-3 the rest of the way and wrapping that up. And I don't see these 3-4 teams going, you know, 7-2 necessarily either, and that includes the Bills. So, you know, I kind of agree with Tom's statement. When you look down the schedule, there's some doability there, and, you know, and Greg Hardy could, in fact, punch out all of them, you know, when the Cowboys play the Patriots. So
thank you.
You never know. But I really am, you know, it really has made it interesting, but at the same time, sad.
Interesting, but sad.
Yeah, so I don't know what you guys...
Compounded by the spree of injuries that continues to affect the league. Obviously, like, Fitzpatrick gets hurt on Sunday. He kind of comes back in for, you know, a series or two, but he is not exactly a spring chicken. And I'm pretty confident that I know what I'm going to get when I play Geno Smith, and it's going to be terrible quarterbacking. So I am all in favor of Geno Smith having more action, despite his fairly decent efforts in relief on Sunday. And then obviously Pittsburgh losing Le'Veon Bell for the season is a huge blow to them. That could be the reason that Pittsburgh kept winning despite Roethlisberger's absence was the rest of the team playing well, in part because of Bell. Now they do not have him to rely on. Obviously Roethlisberger is coming back soon, if he's not back already, actually. But, you know, I think that will definitely affect their outcome, their chances to make the playoffs. Right now, I was looking at the 538 forecast. It has Pittsburgh with a 49% chance of making the playoffs, the Jets with a 46% chance, and then in the AFC, pretty much the next team is Buffalo with a 21% chance. So we're right on the edge. We were in the standings that have us basically eighth. I think the Raiders are potentially someone who could trip us up, but I would say we definitely have our destiny in front of us. And I think that's what the mediocrity allows us, is that we're not going to be sabotaged by solely the Jacksonville loss and the Giants loss. We're going to need to lose two or three more heartbreaking games that we absolutely should have won in order to deny this team a chance at the playoffs.
We should look at the schedule and try and guess which of those games they are.
I can see it right now. One of them's going to be Kansas.
Houston's got to be one you don't expect to lose, you're going to lose.
Oh, I was going to say Kansas City. I thought.
Oh, even better. Yeah, that's a better choice than Houston.
It's our old nemesis, Kansas City. And then also, I feel like the Jets or the Dolphins, one of them will get us. I mean, in a game that they probably shouldn't. Maybe one of those... Maybe that end of season's Jets game. Maybe they're like out of it. They collapse if Fitzpatrick gets hurt, but they still end up beating us in the last game of the season or the second last game, and we end up blowing it, a la 2004, right?
Yeah, that was the Steelers year.
Steelers game, yeah. When the Steelers went in,
all they had to do was beat up the backups, right?
Yep. So
I think, you know what? I think Washington has to be added to the list. I'll add a third team to the list of teams that could beat us that shouldn't. Because they've played some crappy teams well. They're a crappy team that plays other crappy teams well. And if we're playing crappy, they could jag us. They could jag us.
I don't know, man. I feel the giant sucking sound I hear coming from Landover Field or FedEx Field or whatever it's called. I could see that turning in on itself and turning into its own little black hole soon enough. I mean, maybe we'll get sucked in, I suppose, but I think they might be terrible by week 15 or whatever.
Oh, they're awful. I'm not saying they're not. That was kind of the point. Like, if I had to pick a terrible team,
I see.
Maybe accidentally beat the Bills, that would be my, you know, because we would also go to that game.
And watch our team lose. Yeah, exactly.
Right, and be there in charge. So that would add to the.
Actually, I was mistaken, too. Kansas City, it says, has a 28% chance of making the playoffs. So maybe they're not as bad as I predicted.
Dolphins, Jets, Patriots, Chiefs, Texans, Eagles, Redskins, Cowboys. There's a lot of disappointing football teams on there. There's a lot of and that's the problem. There's not a lot of bad football teams. There's just a lot of disappointing football teams. We'll talk about that more later, though. I guess we shouldn't hijack the conversation here.
I'm perfectly comfortable hijacking it.
Okay.
Yeah, especially as I don't know if Paul's still with us. And I'll also say that...
Oh, right, here we go. Paul disappeared.
I'll also say that the Bills are in that group of disappointing teams. I think that's exactly what we are. We're a disappointing team. We had games that we should have won, whether for injury or officiating or just crappy performances. But that said, we still have the whole season kind of... I won't say the whole season, obviously, but we still have enough of the season left to to make it happen.
Right.
Going forward here.
I think that you're going to have to, the thing is you have to look at, okay, now where do you make up the Jacksonville or New York game? Like, what's the game that, like, I think that is the Kansas City game on the schedule and probably like the Eagles game or something, because you have to make up against teams that you were iffy on. Now you have to go ahead and find a team that would have been an okay loss. And
but
make
I think
that
that's
one
the
up.
Point is that you don't have to do that. If everyone in the AFC is crappy, if 9-7 gets you to the playoffs, we're only 6 wins away. It's not that hard to find 6 wins in 9 games.
Dolphins, Jets 3, the Redskins 4. And then but that's what I'm saying. Now you have to beat a team. You have to beat the Dolphins, Jets, and Jets. That's 3 of them. And the Redskins are 4, right? And then you have Cowboys, Eagles, Chiefs, and Texans. And to get to 9-7, you have to get 2 of those.
Yeah, and I think the Texans you would put down. Because the Texans are terrible. And I get we just lost to an AFC South team. We should have won. But again, hopefully we have Tyrod. And that's one.
Yeah.
And then now you only have to get one of those other 5 games. So, yeah, I mean, maybe Kansas City is one. Maybe Dallas is checked out by then. I could see that.
Yeah, I don't know what they're going to do because they're not going to get Romo back in time. And they've already lost 5 in a row. So why even bring him back, right?
That's a good question. But at the same time, I also don't know what the NFC East. The NFC East could just be a huge mishmash of teams at 7-7 going into the last 3 weeks. And so even them with, you know, maybe, you know, Castle starts playing halfway decent, they might be able to squeeze out enough to just kind of stay on the edge of that race and try. I don't know. But I also don't like them coming north to Buffalo. That seems like a terrible – that just doesn't seem like a game that they're going to do well in.
It's on my birthday too, so I don't know.
Well, then that probably means that they're going to win then.
So let's talk briefly about the Jets while Paul is straightening out his issues here, because it looks like Ryan Fitzpatrick will need surgery, but they're going to – but he can play because of pain management. So they'll basically – dope him up and get his hand so it doesn't hurt, and they'll see how well he can throw it. Geno has a big bruise, that's what they're saying, on his shoulder, and that he could play Sunday, but I feel like
he has a large owie on his shoulder.
Right, and I don't – but I think the problem is, like, you know, like, they don't really want him to play. That doesn't mean anything to the Jets. So even though they're ahead of us, do the Jets finally look like a team – because frankly, if Ryan Fitzpatrick was healthy, even if they had lost to the Raiders – I would have said, nope, like, the Jets are the better team, and, like, I would probably be picking the Jets in 2 weeks. But if Geno Smith is playing, or if, I don't know, Matt Flynn, I guess, is they're talking to.
I think the Jets are not that good. I am not impressed by the Jets at all, regardless of them winning or losing. I mean, these are the Jets' wins. 31-10 over the Browns, that's fine. 20-7 over the Colts, that's meaningless. 27-14 over the Dolphins when the Dolphins were playing like crap. That's meaningless. And 34-20 over the Redskins. Also meaningless. They played well in a loss to the Patriots, but at the end of the game, they lost by 7. We lost by 7. It's not a lot to say that they – I think they get – for some reason, they got a lot more credit for them being a short loss. I remember the question on, like, PTI the Monday after that was like, who gets more credit, or who are you more impressed by, the Patriots for beating the Jets or the Jets for playing it close? And it's just like, are you fucking kidding me? They still lost. Like, nobody cares.
That's true. And with the Patriots, you never know. They could just be like, they didn't really try as hard as they had to.
Yeah. So that's why I wasn't that surprised by the Raiders loss. I mean, the Fitzpatrick injury doesn't have anything to do with Derek Carr torching them for 4 touchdowns and Amari Cooper getting open against their corners and them running the ball. The Raiders might actually be good, but the Jets are not. I'm fully confident that we can still beat the Jets twice. And I would not be surprised if that happened at all. I'm all a little right. more worried about the Miami game, but honestly, even that is kind of like, you know, now Miami was playing better, but they also just, you know, Cameron Wake just tore his ACL or whatever. Speaking of right. injuries affecting other teams, you know, that's obviously a huge bummer for Miami. So
let's just talk about the Dolphins game now. And then when Paul gets back, he had some computer issues and he's logging back in shortly. But I think if we get started with the Dolphins game, why don't you tell us why you're worried about it? We handled them in Miami. So ergo, and we're getting all the people back. So
I think, you know, we were real. I'm trying to remember for the Miami game how healthy we were. I mean, we had Taylor. Watkins was out, right?
Yes. Or, well, hold on. I'll look it up now.
No. Williams was
in. Kyle Williams was in.
Well, yeah, Carlos Williams was who I was thinking of.
Oh, yeah.
I'm trying to remember if that was his big game where he went off. But anyway, I mean, I think Miami's playing better now. I mean, I think some of it is, you know, Barnwell was talking about regression to the mean with interim coaches in that you have coaches who are playing so terrible.
Carlos Williams had 110 yards.
Yeah, so there
Sammy
you go.
Sammy Watkins had a catch. I think everybody was playing.
I think Sammy was dinged, but he was.
He had one catch for 39 yards on two targets, right? And then a week or two later, he complained about not getting the ball thrown to him.
And then, so, yeah, so I think Campbell, even if he's not a great coach, simply removed some of the impediments that were clearly slowing down their defense, which obviously played a lot better in their two games against the AFC South opponents. Obviously, they were not great against New England, but very few teams are. I think they are going to be playing better. I think they will also have learned a little bit. I think they can... I think it's tough to beat a team twice in the same season. So I think we can do it. I still think we're going to win this game. I am putting a lot on Tyrod coming back. I think if EJ plays again for some reason, again, it doesn't sound like he is. Tyrod himself was saying he's 100%, which is great, as they've been saying all along, that he's dinged since training
camp.
Yeah,
they said that today. He's 100% for Sunday. So
yeah, so presuming he plays, I think it'll be a closer game than it was before. I don't think we're going to run away with it, but I will say that we're going to win. I'll put it at about...
I'm trying to look up the odds for you now.
I think it was Bills by 3, which everyone was kind of like... Everyone was sort of okay with, even despite the fact that we beat them by 28 at Miami 5 weeks ago or whatever it was.
Yeah, 41-14. But I think you're right. I think it's not just that Buffalo, because Buffalo was healthy enough to beat the Giants, and they played a terrible game, right?
Yeah.
And then you could chalk up the Patriots being the Patriots, and the Bengals and Jaguars to no Tyrod Taylor. But you've still got to look at, they only won 14-13 in Tennessee, and they lost 24-10 to New York, the Giants. So I think there is some concern. I think some of that concern will be dissipated. I think the bye week off and everybody sort of kind of resetting might be perfect for this team. Sort of everybody on offense sort of resets. We can talk out our issues about who's getting targeted enough and how we're going to approach things. And the defense can say, hey, how can we get some sacks here? Because we'd like to tee off on the quarterback if at all possible, and get back to what we're used to doing. So I think that it might not be 41-14, but I think Miami's is clearly the inferior team. I think they just are. So I'm gonna go ahead and I'm gonna take Buffalo as well in this match. I think we're gonna get back to some good football.
Yeah, Paul, we skipped ahead to the preview of the Dolphins game, but we will come back to this day in Bills history.
Right, yeah, we'll conclude with that. God, I had this terrible nightmare that I was in the middle of a sentence and my computer entirely froze. Just froze and dropped a call. So thank God that didn't happen in the middle of a podcast. Anyway, nope. Now that nightmare is over. Yeah, I would, I heard most of the tail end of what you were saying, Frank, and you said as well, which makes you think that Scott relatively agrees. I think it is a much-needed bye. It is kind of interesting that, you know, I did speculate that after the Jags game, the Bills might be the first team to beat a team 41-14 on the road and then be home underdogs to that same team 6 weeks later. But the Dolphins laid that egg in New England. They have not really beaten many good teams, as we mentioned. They have battled the Bills. They've been their nemesis in terms of competing for the title of the AFC East most underperforming team. And it's a game that both teams really need to have. The Dolphins would be 3-5, 0-4 in the AFC East, and 2-5 in the AFC with a loss. And they would not wake up. That's my Cameron Wake pun, probably, for the rest of the year. And then I think the Bills, they would also be 3-5. They'd be 1-2 in the AFC East, 3-4 in the AFC, and 1-4 at home. So a lot of negative consequences for a loss for both teams. I think the Bills are just a bit better, and I'm going to say the Bills take this one 17-13.
All right.
Ooh, a defensive struggle you're predicting.
Yep, I am, because let's face it, look at these offenses. That's my argument.
I mean, honestly, I think that's the thing, is I would say that with Tyrod, I think the Bills' offense is arguably as good, if not better, than the defense, to be perfectly honest.
They had two bad games with the offense, right? Like the Giants and the Bills with Taylor. And he might have been injured, so or playing injuredly.
Right. Playing gingerly, let's say.
Yeah, sure. That's a good word.
So, yeah, well, so we'll see how it that'll be a discussion for another day. We don't want to go too long into this podcast, especially since I abandoned you guys in the middle of it. Right. So, you know, we'll wrap up, I guess, with this day in Bills history, which I'll keep brief, unless we got any more points you want to make on the game.
No, I'm good. I don't think the Dolphins are very good.
All right. So this day in Bills history, I thought about a Bills-Dolphins game, but it was from it was way back in November 2nd of 1997. But this was a 9-6 win, and without looking up the box score, I seem to remember this was a game where Alex Van Pelt was sold as the future and given a game ball in a game where his team won 9-6. I don't even. Someone should look up the box score of that game and see what he got the game ball for. But his numbers were terrible. So let's depress ourselves instead with a more recent game going back to November 2nd of 2008. One of the beginning of the end games of a season that started 5-2 for the Bills, 5-1, had a lead in the fourth quarter against the Dolphins, blew that game, got safety, you know, went back home, 5-2 record, licking their wounds. So they go up against the New York Jets. This is what that Bills offense was like at that time. There was a span of 15 minutes and 8 seconds in this game where the Bills offense had the ball the entire time. During that span of time, they were outscored 7-0. That's hard to do. So you basically had to go on what was an 8-plus minute drive where they got intercepted at the 8 and it was run back for a touchdown. Then they get right back to the 8-yard line. They go for it on 4th-and-1, and Fred Jackson can't convert it, and that was it. And what's hilarious is the Bills won the time of possession battle by 2 seconds this game. So they had the ball total in the game for 30 minutes and 1 second, and 15 minutes, more than half of that, was like one stretch of time consecutively. This was Trent Edwards' garbage number game, 24 of 35 for 289. He had a touchdown and 2 interceptions. He also lost a fumble, which led to the Jets scoring 3 points plus his pick six. So he led out to the Jets scoring 10 points, and what ended up being a 9-point loss. It was a receiver named Stevie Johnson pulled in a pass this game, only a second career catch for Buffalo. Marshawn, 9 carries, 16 yards. Fred, 7 carries, 15 yards. Terrible game offensively, not a great game defensively. This was really when we started to see who the Bills team really was that season after their hot start. So let's hope this year's team is the inverse of that and they start as poorly as they've started this year by expectation. And let's hope they can rebound and do the opposite of the 2018. So the trivia question, let's just go with this one. It's not easy. I don't think either of you will get it, although Scott tends to get these almost 100% nowadays. But
I do what I can.
I'll give you guys a shot anyway. A Buffalo Bills player caught his only career touchdown catch in this game, in a game in which he managed 4 carries for 43 yards. Who was this Bills player?
What year was it again?
2008.
2008.
All right.
So this is not that long ago.
No, yep. It's not. It's newer. It's post us.
This is in the canon.
We watched this game in Crystal City, I believe, at your place, Frank.
4 carries for 48 yards, and he caught a touchdown?
Yep. Four receptions for 43.
4 catches. Is it a wide receiver, or do you not want to say?
I will say it is not a wide receiver. That would be my hint.
Okay.
He also had the same last name of someone who would occasionally watch the games with us, but I don't think either of you will remember that detail, so you can just kind of put that out of here. It's not like one of our close buddies, but I remember this last name.
Mark Lapierre? I'm gonna say, I don't know. I'm just thinking of last names now, people. Okay, I'm gonna pass. I'll just say Kelly Holcomb. I know it's wrong, but I don't know.
I think it was interesting. The first thing that I was thinking about, what is the position? You get 4 rushes for 34 yards, right? But then he caught the touchdown pass.
Yes, but again, to correct it was actually 4 receptions for 43 yards.
4 receptions for 34
yards. Not 4 rushes. So I probably screwed that up.
Okay, so now that is interesting because that does change my answer. because originally I thought it was going to be some like fullback or something, and I was trying to think of like who's a fullback who used to catch a pass or two for us like in that time frame, and I'm trying to think of who would have been a fullback back then. It would have been like
probably like Damon whatever, Damon Sheldon
was Damon Shelton or something, like somebody like that. But then now that you said that it was not four rushes but four passes, that now that helped me, it clicked into focus. Emmanuel Velikovsky.
Yeah, that's right, because we used to know Jim Velikovsky.
Yeah, exactly. And so Emmanuel was the guy, he was with the Bills in 08, but then he also wrote Worlds in Collision in 1950, where he said that the Earth had suffered all those catastrophic close contacts with Venus and Mars during like ancient times, and then he also wrote like a bunch of books later saying that like, oh, like this Egyptian dynasty, like the 19th dynasty of the Middle Kingdom of Egypt, actually happened much later than we all think it did, and then like it got repudiated a bunch later, and then he went on to go play for the Bills. But yeah, Emmanuel Velikovsky.
Wow, and that's really especially impressive. You consider him catching four passes in this game when he died in 1979. I mean, that in and of itself is
really. He's a warrior. He's a warrior. We'll see. Maybe I'll put his picture up on the website on the Facebook page, and you know, people can just see. You know, he's a battered stone cold warrior.
Yep. Yeah, that is a good description of him. So the battered stone cold warrior. Emmanuel, I can't even pronounce this name.
Velikovsky.
Go with the Russian speaker. I should have let you pronounce the name. Shouldn't have even tried, so I'm glad you did.
Well, it actually could be Velikovsky.
Right. No,
it's actually not. Velikovsky. Yeah.
He did go by his American nickname, of course, which was Derek Fine.
Oh, of course, yes. Well, yeah, I mean, again, because the whole dying thing, he had to go through the name change process that happens when you die. So,
right.
Derek Fine, one of the Derek's at tight end.
Yep, one of the Schumann Fine, the law firm of Schumann and Fine, the tight end firm of Schumann and Fine. So that was November 2nd. That was 2007. So we've got a game coming up November 8th, 2015. We have already done that discussion, so I'm in the awkward position of outroing the podcast from the This Day in Bills History. If you have any questions that you would like to ask of us, you have many options. There's BBillsMNY, Twitter, BBillsMNY, Facebook. I always just say, just Google Buffalo Bills Podcast. We're going to be on that first page. You can find us on iTunes. You can really find us anywhere on the World Wide Web. Obviously, if you're listening to this message, you've found us. So continue to find us in the way in which you have found us, and that would be good. You know, we've got an enjoyable game coming up this weekend, God willing. We've got a healthy Bills team. Should be worth watching. I will be interacting with you on Twitter. Scott will be... Where are you going to be? Is this game on there in D.C.? Guys, probably don't know yet.
Yeah, I don't know if it will be.
So that was November 2nd. That was 2007. So we've got a game coming up November 8th, 2015. We have already done that discussion, so I'm in the awkward position of outroing the podcast from the This Day in Bills History. If you have any questions that you would like to ask of us, you have many options. There's BBillsMNY, Twitter, BBillsMNY, Facebook. I always just say, just Google Buffalo Bills Podcast. We're going to be on that first page. You can find us on iTunes. You can really find us anywhere on the World Wide Web. Obviously, if you're listening to this message, you've found us. So continue to find us in the way in which you have found us, and that would be good. You know, we've got an enjoyable game coming up this weekend, God willing. We've got a healthy Bills team. Should be worth watching. I will be interacting with you on Twitter. Scott will be... Where are you going to be? Is this game on there in D.C.? Guys, you probably don't know yet.
Yeah, I don't know if it will be. Yeah, that's a good question, actually. Someone should know the answer to that.
It's almost certainly not. I mean, Bills-Dolphins is not going to rate very well with probably an early Redskins.